Electricity, a big idea that's inspired countless new ones. From powering the light bulb to virtually powering our entire lives. 30 years ago, State Street launched the Spider S&P 500 ETF, SPY. A big idea that inspired the world to invest differently. And still does. What can you do with SPY?
Before investing, consider the fund's investment objectives, risks, charges, and expenses. Visit SSGA.com for a prospectus containing this and other information. Read it carefully before investing. SPY is subject to risks similar to those of stocks. All ETFs are subject to risk, including possible loss of principal. Alps Distributors, Inc. Distributor.
You're listening to The Exchange. Here's today's show.
Thanks very much, Scott, and welcome to The Exchange on this Friday afternoon. I'm Dominic Chu, and here's what's ahead on the show. Stocks unable to sustain their gains following that stronger-than-expected jobs number. The S&P and NASDAQ now negative after both hitting each record-high levels. The Dow is on pace for its worst week since October. But Fundstrat's Tom Lee believes in the 2024 stock market, where he's seeing opportunities now. That's coming up. And while the unemployment rate did tick higher, the amount of prime-aged women in the workforce climbed to nearly 78% and is hovering near at a record high level. That still, though, lags other developed nations, and the Department of Labor estimates it's costing the U.S. more than $775 billion in economic activity each year. We'll dig into what needs to change to get more women into the workforce. Plus, President Biden calling for higher corporate taxes and increased incentives for some Americans in last night's State of the Union. This as both the House and the Senate vote on spending bills this week. What's in each of them, what it all means for Wall Street, and the names poised to benefit from Biden's agenda, all coming up. But we begin with today's market action. And right now, sector-wise, it is the end of the week. And so we'll call your attention to what's happening right now with regard to some of the movement that we are seeing in the markets. Again, I alluded to the fact that we're down for most of the major indices here. The Dow Industrials, though, just about flat on the session. The S&P 500 gets a star because even though it is a half percent down, it did hit a record high today. And the NASDAQ Composite pacing the declines down about 1% or so. 16,107 is the level for the NASDAQ Composite, down 1%. The S&P is down about half of 1% at 5,129. And the Dow Industrials, again, down about 29 points to 38,759. With regard to what's happening elsewhere, check out the other record level that we watched today. And that's in Bitcoin prices, currently at $68,462 and change. That's up nearly $600, up 1%. Again, record highs here. And just for reference, the new record at one point very briefly today, it did cross that 70,000 mark to roughly 70,170, depending on which exchange you look at. But Bitcoin, certainly a focus. On the sector side of things for the stock market, believe it or not, we've had a decent week, but the gains have not been powered by what you think. Over the last week, the top performing sectors on Wall Street in the S&P, the utilities, again, the materials and real estate, some of those names doing some of the heavy lifting in terms of where we saw the action. So not technology. And speaking of, we are seeing a bit of a bounce today. Apple shares for sure catching a bid up 1.75%, $171.89. It's on pace right now to snap a 7-day losing streak as investors start to take a look at whether or not these levels, again, trying to approach some of those October lows that we saw, is enough of a catalyst for some value buying and or short covering. We'll keep an eye on that Apple trade. Now, stronger than expected job gains in February, raising concerns that inflation could still pose a problem for the Fed. Non-farm payrolls rose by 275,000, while the unemployment rate ticked up higher to 3.9%. Wage growth, cooler than expected, but still gaining 0.1%. But job growth in both December and January, both revised lower. So what's the Fed's next move? Joining me now is Diane Swonk, the chief economist over at KPMG. Also, CNBC senior economics reporter Steve Leisman. Thank you both for being here. Let's take us through the numbers, Steve, and why some traders may call it a Goldilocks scenario, but is it really?
Well, it's a little bit of a Rorschach test is what I'm reading about it, Dom. And you can really separate the numbers into those numbers that argued for the Fed to cut a little sooner and then for them not to cut or cut a little later. When I look at the numbers, well, 167,000 of downward revisions, that spoke of slack in the labor market. You had moderating wage growth, and you also had a higher unemployment rate, up 0.2. A lot of that stuff can be turned around and be exactly the opposite, which is you had payroll growth still above 200,000, annual wage growth north of 4%, the unemployment rate still below 4%. So I think the Fed looks at this data and says, you know what? I'm not making any calls on this data, especially because you have this big gap between the household and the payroll employment. I think they wait for all this stuff to shake out before making up their mind to do anything else.
Diane, that's the read, and that's generally what I've heard from some of the economists out there. Do you feel as though that's the correct way to interpret this data? And is this the way that the Fed is looking at this data ahead of key inflation data next week?
Well, the inflation data is really going to be important, but there's a big threshold to have the Fed change its sort of game plan in terms of a June rate cut and three rate cuts for the year, and that's their signal. The threshold would have to be either a very cool or a very hot inflation number to signal maybe a May cut instead of a June cut. But I think this sort of is steady as she goes. And that's really what we heard from Jay Powell this week as well. I think the most important thing in the data is that we're still continuing to see average hourly earnings picked up after dipping last month. And that bounce back and that persistence of new paychecks coming online is buoying consumer demand. And what the Fed continues to worry about is sort of walking this tightrope between not wanting to overshoot on having rates too high for too long, but then still looking at this and saying, well, you know, we're still generating a lot of demand, particularly in the service sector, where we worry about inflation being the stickiest. Now,
Diane, let's follow up on that really quickly. The inflation stickiest part has gravitated in recent weeks towards this idea that shelter costs, rent, that sort of thing plays an important role in some of the sticky inflation. If you look at the way that the jobs picture is shaping up right now, will there be a scenario where the jobs data can somehow withstand what could be a bigger decline in housing, which would help then rein in some of those inflation measures?
Well, in terms of the inflation measures, I think the biggest issue is what is going to happen to service sector costs outside of shelter costs, because that's going to be, there's a lot of weird things going on in shelter costs. And actually, the Bureau of Labor Statistics did a great webinar on that yesterday publicly, very technical, but I think it's important to keep that in mind. But more importantly, the underlying service sector, we're starting to see an uptick in the usage of medical and benefits because quit rates have fallen. People are staying longer in the jobs they have and are now using more of the benefits. That, along with aging demographics, are putting upward pressure on costs and pricing in the medical sector. And that's an area the Fed's going to watch very closely. We also see aging baby boomers are traveling more. And that, along with those people who are working, those people out on vacation in February were still extremely elevated. And the TSA throughput of the week of the survey, President's Week, showed travel was up at a double-digit rate in terms of air travel in this week in February versus 2019. So that upward pressure on services is still there. And that's what the Fed's going to be looking at in terms of, is that creating too high of a floor for inflation that it can't go down further, even though we're going to see additional declines in things like new vehicle prices, because frankly, dealer lots are now bloated and they're offering incentives again.
Hey, Steve, what should we be focusing more on, or what are we focusing not enough on?
You know, I think the totality of it is what you need to focus on. The wage, the hours worked, the total jobs. I will say one thing. Diane is right. This is not enough to alter the Fed's outlook. But I will say this. Think about it like when a ref starts counting the pinning of a wrestler. One, two, gets up, start again in the count. This is one when it comes to the uptick in the unemployment rate. It's the thing that I'm most interested in. If this thing starts to tick up for a couple months in a row, you go one, two, three, that could accelerate the Federal Reserve in terms of their possibility of rate cuts.
Okay. Now, guys, I just stay right there because I want to pivot a little bit towards what's happening right now with regard to International Women's Day. It's a big deal here. Let's dig deeper into the workforce dynamic with regard to participation among women in the workforce, especially something called that prime-aged category. It makes it sound like meat, but in essence, we're trying to get at something where people of a certain age bracket are working more. Diane, you've been doing extensive work on this in women in the workplace. What exactly are you seeing trend-wise from the data with regard to that dynamic in America's workforce?
Well, no, sadly, I'm actually out of that prime age category because that's 25 to 54-year-olds. So
you wouldn't
I'm
know
above
it, Diane.
It,
you wouldn't know it by looking at you.
Thank you. But the good news is that we're seeing these, you know, prime age participation of women hit a record high in 2023. We actually saw much of those gains driven by college educated women with children under three, and the pivot to work from home and hybrid all helped that. That said, it's over 20 years since we saw the last peak when my children were little. That we saw the last peak in women's labor force participation, which was on the tail end of the 1990s boom. And what we're seeing is we went from leading the world in terms of women's participation in the workplace to lagging the developed world in women's participation in the workplace. And that Department of Labor study that you cited earlier on about how much more economic activity we could have in the economy if more women were participating. If we had a participation rate in prime age women that was commensurate with sort of our neighbors to the north in Canada or Germany, we would have 5 million more women, prime age women, working today than they do. We've also seen voluntary part-time work pick up, but in part because childcare problems are included in voluntary part-time. And I think that's very important as well. We know we're in a childcare crisis in the United States. And even though parental leave keeps hitting sort of record highs, people out due to childcare problems also are hitting record highs in a month. And that's despite the fact that the birth rate picked up in 2021, but has not picked up since then. We've seen an expansion of parental leave, but we don't have anything like that in other countries. And of course, it accrues to those college-educated women, again, get more flexibility because they have office work with more flexibility post-pandemic as well. So we've still got a long way to go, but the childcare crisis and the costs of childcare are really stunning, and how much it's disrupting the labor market, even today, as we look at the figures in today's data, is really significant, and it's not going away. And I think that's something that we have to think about much more holistically in the economy in order to not just catch up or cross a peak hit over 20 years ago. We need all hands on deck. We need both men and women participating in the labor market to their fullest. And it's not a zero-sum game. And I think we're leaving a lot of talent on the sidelines because we're not being very accommodative to working parents more broadly.
Steve, I mean, you've done reporting on this before as well. I know just how significant of an impact could it be? And would it be a sort of panacea, if you will, for the U.S. economy if we could get more people into the workforce, especially when it comes to bringing women into the labor force as well?
Well, I don't know if this is a little bit controversial, but I think getting more people into the workforce, yes, we need that. But I think the gold standard, now, Diane, tell me if I'm wrong or even sexist on this issue. I think the gold standard is having the choice to be in the workforce, right? And I think that's something that
Absolutely.
Really we should aim for here. Okay, so if women do not want to work, or if couples do not want one of the spouses to work, that's a nice choice to be able to have. It begins with being able to find affordable healthcare to be able to make that choice, not healthcare, but childcare to make that choice. So I would just slightly make it a little different. The gold standard is the choice to work or not, depending upon how people want to raise their children culturally and socially. One of the things that the Biden administration did, I think, which was important, was when they restored the legal immigration tracks post-pandemic, it was a very sort of amusing thing to me to watch, which was, well, you couldn't have foreigners coming in. And what was one of the big jobs that some foreigners did? They were au pairs. So you had the number of women dropping out of the workforce because there weren't the child care to do it. That's come back. We are in a better place here, but I completely agree with Diane. We could do a lot better.
All right. This is perfect. We couldn't have set it up any better. Diane Swonk at KPMG, our own Steve Leisman, thank you both very much, and have a nice weekend to you both. All right, guys. So let's turn now to someone who knows a thing or two about childcare, the economy, and the affordability crisis that's facing this country. The government aid that kept thousands of programs afloat during the pandemic expired back in September. Our next guest says we are still in the early innings of the fallout from that so-called childcare cliff. Joining me now is Stephen Kramer, the CEO of Bright Horizons. Bright Horizons is one of the biggest for-profit childcare center institutions in America. So you've got a big view on not just the micro issues facing the industry, but the macro as well. Stephen, you just heard the interview from Diane Swonk and Steve Leisman. How big of an issue is it, and how much is the American economy being held back because we cannot find enough affordable, quality childcare?
Yeah, so we're in total agreement with that last segment. You know, my perspective on this is that access to high quality, affordable childcare is holding working parents back from their ability to work and ultimately is holding back the economy. And so to the extent that we can find ways, and Bright Horizons has been doing it for 35 years, partnering with employers to invest billions of dollars into childcare, that is a way forward for children, for working parents, and ultimately for society and the economy.
Stephen, what makes childcare so unaffordable for Americans? Is it a mix of the real estate costs that go along with things? Is it the shortage of labor or the cost of labor? What's the mix of things that drives healthcare costs higher in this country?
Yeah, the number one reason why childcare is expensive the way it is because it is expensive to attract, retain, train high quality teachers and practitioners. And ultimately, in order to have high quality in childcare, you need those great people. And the vast majority of the cost structure of any high quality childcare program is tied into those who are delivering the magic every day in the classrooms and the heroes on the front lines who are the teachers in the classrooms.
What exactly does this country need to do? What does a future administration in this country need to do in order to make it so that we have more bandwidth for childcare at a price point that most Americans can actually afford?
Yeah, look, I think that as we look around the world and we think about what are the ways in which we can solve this crisis, it really is going to come down to a number of different things. But fundamentally, it needs to be about making childcare more affordable for working parents. And great examples around the world focus on direct subsidies. They focus on tax incentives, both to individual families as well as to employers who should be incented to get involved in providing childcare, like many of our clients do each and every day for their employees.
And really quickly, before we let you go, you partner with a lot of companies to offer this kind of benefit and service. What can companies do?
Yeah, so we partner with 1,400 employer clients across the economy. And what they are doing every day is providing access to on-site subsidized childcare for their employees. They're providing access to backup childcare when an employee has a breakdown in childcare. And they're really thinking across all the life stages to ensure that their employer is able to attract and retain the best talent. And again, employers have a vested interest in this, and we're excited to continue to partner with employers to solve what is a meaningful childcare challenge.
All right, Stephen Kramer at Bright Horizons on the childcare crisis in America. Thank you very much. Have a nice weekend, sir.
Thank you.
All right. Well, speaking of employers, Gen Z teens are back to work and more powerful than ever. Kate Rogers is here with more on that aspect of the economic story. Kate.
Hey, Dom. Teens ages 16 to 19 are working again after a big dip seen in 2020. Nearly a third of teens were working as of February. That's a number that's held fairly steady in recent months and peaked in July of 2023. They're also, interestingly, seeing wages rise faster than other age cohorts. Dave Dittenberg has spent his career in the restaurant industry, and he's looking to hire teens who see the job as more than just a paycheck. About a quarter of his 150 workers are teens, and he recruits via a Department of Labor apprenticeship program with a focus on hospitality. The message here, this can be more than a first-time job with opportunities to advance.
You know, for Michigan, we're the second largest employer where the industry is. We're a $44 billion industry. And, you know, management can range anywhere from $70,000 to $100,000. So those are careers, right? And we need to be able to convey and communicate those messages to the kids.
He's offering more scheduling flexibility and even some perks for teen workers, including things like gym memberships. Chase Georges is one of Dittenberg's 17-year-old employees. The high school senior works on the kitchen line and hopes to stay in the industry after graduation.
I normally work around 20, 24 hours, and I found it really easy to balance out my school time with work, and they're very, very negotiable with schedules in case if I need more time to do school.
Now, it is worth noting the long-term trend here is that there are fewer teens working today than there were in the 1970s, 1980s. But kids also, Dom, of course, have different pressures on them, including extracurriculars, rather, college prep, that are more competitive than they were in the past. But really an interesting trend here.
Absolutely. The evolution of the workforce on the young side of things. Kate Rogers, thank you very much. We've now got a news alert on Apple, and Steve Kovac has more on that story. Steve.
Hey, Dom. Yeah, Apple has reinstated Epic Games developer account in the European Union. Epic Games, of course, is the company that makes Fortnite and has been in this long-drawn legal battle across many jurisdictions, including here in the U.S., with Apple over its App Store policies. This is a little complicated, so let me back up a second and kind of explain what's going on here. Apple, just earlier this week, removed the developer's account, which Epic was able to gain because of this new law in the EU called the Digital Markets Act, which went into full effect just yesterday. Since Epic did that, though, Phil Schiller, who is in charge of the App Store, he's the executive at Apple in charge of the App Store, sent a letter to Epic Games saying, we're going to remove your account. One, because you've been kind of blasting us publicly on social media, kind of deriding our policies and things like that. Two, you've also been in litigation with us, both in the United States and Australia. And three, basically saying, 3.5-4 years ago, you guys purposely broke the rules, which kind of spurred off all this litigation, saying there's a lack of trust and so forth like that. Today, totally reversing course. And the only thing that's really changed here, Dom, is that Digital Markets Act went into effect. And the European Commission, just yesterday, within just an hour or so after the law went into effect, the European Commission telling us, we're looking into Apple's practices here. And just under all this pressure, Apple telling us and Epic Games telling us now that that Apple has reinstated the account. Apple says its rationale is because Epic Games has agreed to follow all of their rules and so forth in the App Store. That's true, but also Epic Games agreed to do that days ago before the DMA even went into effect. So the only thing that's really changed here is regulators started working on it. This is going to be a long, drawn-out battle here, though, but because as we're seeing, this tough law here in the EU is having real effect on Apple and how it operates its App Store. So this is just one beat in a very, very long story, Dom.
Okay, Steve Kovac with Liz Sarah. Thank you very much. Thing. Coming up on the show, stocks notching new all-time highs today. But that's no surprise to our next guest, who says this stronger market is thanks to a healthier backdrop overall. Fundstrat's Tom Lee joins us to explain, and he tells us where he's still seeing opportunity and where stocks are going from here. Plus, President Biden taking aim at corporate America in his State of the Union address last night. We'll look at the policy implications and whether Congress will be able to avoid a partial government shutdown this time around. The exchange is back after this.
This is The Exchange on CNBC.
Did you hear that? That's what an estimated 500 horsepower sounds like.
Exco, give it to you.
How about that? That's a premium Bang & Olufsen sound system with 18 speakers and a Beosonic sound experience. And that's our legacy. Ready to be a part of it?
Let's go, give it to you.
Unlock the energy of the all-electric ZDX Type S.
Give up.
Order now at Acura.com.
What's on the horizon for financial markets? At PGIM, it's a question that over 1,400 investment professionals relentlessly research in pursuit of your long-term goals. Specialized across asset classes, but united in collaboration. Our teams provide global and local expertise. Our investments shape tomorrow, today. Pursue your tomorrow with PGIM, a leading global asset manager.
Welcome to The Exchange. The S&P and the NASDAQ touching record highs after that hot jobs report, both on pace for their eighth positive week in the last nine. Our next guest says there is still more room to run. Joining me now is Tom Lee, Managing Partner and Head of Research at Fundstrat Global Advisors. He is also a CNBC contributor. Tom, it's great to have you here. Always great to get your thoughts. And you've been right, because the market just keeps hitting new highs. Today's intraday action may be a little bit disconcerting for some. Is the leadership still intact, though, for the markets overall?
Dom, I think it's a good question because the market is extended and it is a mature rally. We're going to be entering our 20th week next week, but I think we should be giving the stock market the benefit of the doubt. So today, stocks are wobbling. Not a surprise that there is some profit taking. We did actually have a good jobs number, so I'm probably saying one eyebrow is raised because we're selling off on good news. But with margin debt where it is, and I think the earnings backdrop being so strong and the Fed confirming that they're leaning towards cuts this year, I think the backdrop, as you noted earlier, is still very good for equities.
What exactly is going to drive that? We've talked about this idea. It could be underlying earnings growth. It might be the idea of people paying more for that dollar of earnings expected, multiple expansions, so to speak. What's the big tailwind that you see coming up for the markets overall?
It's really all three. I think there is upside to earnings. Earnings beat by 7% in the first quarter, so you're already one quarter in. If consensus is 245, well, that means there could be $10, $15 of upside for just this year on earnings alone. On risk premia, which is what you should put as a PE multiple, well, if the Fed starts cutting and the economy's resilient, the PE is only 15 times ex-FANG. And the third is really flows. There's still $6 trillion of cash on the sidelines. Margin debt is barely budged. It's below where it was in October 2023, which was just a few months ago. So I don't think investors are necessarily that risk on. I mean, I know the market is technically overbought, but Mark Newton, our head of technical strategy, says you don't really want to be, using an overbought as actually a sell signal because strong markets stay strong.
Tom, you mentioned the idea that leverage isn't what it used to be at points in the past. Does that take a massive market decline off the table? And if we did get a decline, how big in your mind could it be?
For now, I think it does mitigate downside because when leverage is low, like margin debt at the NYSE, it means investors aren't long, yet the backdrop is improving, so that means they have to use these pullbacks as chances to get long. But at the same time, we expect an air pocket in the first half, something like 7% or more. It's just that there's so many top callers now that I think that's why there's still gas in the tank on this rally.
All right, and last question. We have a few moments. The favorite part of the market for you, given the current valuation?
There's what I think are five things that are working this year. I don't want to talk about all five, but to me, we know that technology and FANG, including NVIDIA, are working because of AI. And I think that's also pulling up, the miners and Bitcoin because they are kind of correlated trades. The second thing that seems to be working are things that are related around Ozempic and reducing weight loss because of the productivity benefit to workers. But to me, the third, maybe most interesting, is small caps. We think there's 50% upside this year. They're trading at 44% of the price to book of large caps. So I do think that's really one of the sleeper stories this year.
All right. Small caps to trade from Tom Lee at Fundstrat. Thank you very much. Have a nice weekend, Tom.
Thanks. You too.
All right. Well, coming up on the show, this weekend marks 1 year since the collapse of Silicon Valley Bank, and startups are still feeling the effects. We'll tell you what some of the bank's former clients are saying and where the opportunities still are for investors in Silicon Valley.
That's what an estimated 500 horsepower sounds like.
Exco, give it to you.
How about that? That's a premium Bang & Olufsen sound system with 18 speakers and a Biosonic sound experience.
Acura wins Daytona.
And that's our legacy. You ready to be a part of it?
Exco, give it to you.
Unlock the energy of the all-electric ZDX Type S.
Give up.
Order now at Acura.com.
Well,
Welcome back to The Exchange, everybody. I'm Tyler Matheson with your news update. An aid ship, will be heading to Gaza as a test mission for a new humanitarian sea corridor. This according to the European Union Commission president today. The news comes as President Joe Biden announced that the U.S. military is going to build a temporary pier in Gaza along the Mediterranean, as aid groups say the blockade and fighting in Gaza made it nearly impossible for supplies to enter the region. The political group No Labels just announced that it will name a presidential ticket soon after months of weighing the idea of a so-called unity ticket. No Labels says a formal process for potential candidates will likely begin next week. And France will use artificial intelligence for surveillance during the Paris Olympics this summer. Police, firefighters, public transport, security services, all going to be allowed to use the technology. France, the first European country to legalize the use of AI surveillance, brushing aside warnings from rights groups that it could threaten civil liberties. Dom, back to you.
All right, Tyler Matheson, thank you very much for the news update there. Coming up on the show, corporate taxes and consumer costs at the top of the White House's economic agenda. Up next, we'll tell you what it means for Wall Street and get a trader's take on the stocks that could benefit in three buys and a bail. That edition coming up next. Welcome back to The Exchange. President Biden's State of the Union speech sandwiched between two congressional votes on a spending bill that would avoid a government shutdown. The House passed it on Wednesday, and the Senate is set to vote on it today. Emily Wilkins has the latest developments from Washington, D.C., while PIMCO's Libby Cantrill joins to discuss the policy and general election impacts of last night's address. Emily, we begin with you.
Well, hey, Dom Lee, after months of delaying action on funding the government, the Senate is finally poised to pass a $460 billion package to fund the government for the remainder of the fiscal year. So this is not that stopgap. They're actually funding the government. They just took a procedural motion vote, moving that continuing to go forward. And they're on track to avoid that partial government shutdown that was otherwise set to start at midnight tonight. Now, we don't yet know when the final vote will be, but we do know a little bit about this package. It includes several foreign policy measures like preventing the sale of any oil in the Strategic Petroleum Reserve to China. And it would also strengthen tracking and review of foreign ownership of U.S. forest land and farmland. Congress is also cutting the budget for a key agency that's leading the way on AI. The National Institute of Standards and Technology will have its budget cut up 10% from last fiscal year, even as the Biden administration has tasked it with developing standards for AI, managing risk with the new technology, and helping identify what types of AI could be harmful. Now, even if lawmakers do avoid a shutdown today, the biggest challenge is yet to come. The next tranche of government funding bills is due March 22nd, and lawmakers tell me that these are the harder bills to get done. It's going to be more of a challenge to find an agreement, and of course, it contains the bulk of government funding, including several critical departments like the Department of Defense. Dom?
All right. Emily Wilkins in Washington, D.C. with the latest there. Thank you very much. Let's turn now to Libby Cantrill for a deeper dive into the policy impacts of Biden's economic agenda as laid out last night by the State of the Union. Libby, as you were watching it, what stood out to you as the key focal point or key message that the president was trying to get across, not just Congress, but of course to the American people?
Yeah, well, good afternoon, Dom. I mean, in some ways, from a policy perspective, this was a rehashing of many of the policies that President Biden ran on in 2020 that he's repeated in other State of the Union. So I'm not sure there was that much that's new. He did reinforce a few things, though, that are, I think, important or potentially important to the market. He leaned into this idea of increasing the corporate tax rate from 21% to 28%. He also supported this idea of quadrupling the buyback tax, the surcharge from 1% to 4%, among some other tax changes, including a 25% wealth tax for those who have $100 million more of assets. However, and this is a big however, and something that we are reinforcing to our clients, is that so much of his ability to get this done in 2025, should he win re-election, will really depend on whether he has a cooperative Congress. Does he have a Democratic Senate and a Democratic House? I think that's a real open question, just given the pretty difficult map for Democrats. It does look in the Senate. It looks like it may be difficult for them to keep the Senate. So as a result, I think we are just guiding our clients to sort of just, you take this with a big grain of salt. This is sort of more populist from an economic perspective, but probably is going to be difficult to actually translate into policy, even if he were to win a re-election.
So that's down ballot stuff, right? That's this idea that you need to see other elections besides just the one at the top of the chain go the way that you need it to go, whether you're a Republican or a Democrat. What is the handicapping process that you're going through right now from a policy perspective on how you're telling people how these down ballot elections could play out and what effects it will have on the economic agenda that any president would want to lay out?
Yeah, I think that actually as much focus is on the election around the White House, around the presidential election, that might be a little sexier and more interesting. We would argue that actually for this election cycle in particular, just given the dynamics in both the Senate, which the Democrats control by a very slim margin right now, and the dynamics in the House, which Republicans control by a very slim margin, they're basically both up for grabs this election cycle, Dom. So again, just given the challenging map of seats in states that are up for re-election in the Senate, Democrats, it looks like the odds favor Democrats for losing the Senate, but they may actually have a higher chance of taking back the House. And in which case, and this is sort of the important punchline here, is that for all of either candidates, President Biden or former President Trump, whatever they talk about fiscal policy and what they want to do in 2025, just remember that if they have a split Congress, they're going to be able to do much, much less than what they may be suggesting on the campaign trail.
Libby, it sounds like we've talked about these issues in past election cycles, this idea that gridlock is good for Wall Street in some ways. Are you forecasting more of a gridlock type situation no matter who wins the White House?
Well, actually, and the data would corroborate that, Dom. If you look at just the S&P, its performance since the 1950s, the stock market actually performs better typically under divided government or split Congress. So that has actually been sort of, again, verified by data. You know, I think it's just too early to tell at this point. Of course, we're just in March. it's sort of unbelievable. I know it feels like the general election campaign's already been going on for several months. You know, usually in a typical presidential election cycle, we would just be getting sort of the beginning of the primary process. But because we basically, for all intents and purposes, know the presidential nominees for each of the parties, we're already pivoting to sort of policy prognostications. But what we're telling clients is it's still early. You know, don't extrapolate too much from the head-to-head polls and even on the down ballot races. It's just too difficult to guess and handicap at this point whether we'll see a split Congress or, you know, a red wave or even, you know, even though it seems less likely, a Democratic wave.
All right. Libby Cantrell with PIMCO with the latest state of play. Thank you very much. We'll see you soon.
Thanks, Tom.
All right. So now that the Biden's roadmap has been laid out, which stocks could actually benefit here? We've got three names to buy and one to avoid in today's edition of Three Buys and a Bail. Our trader of record today is Chris Crisanti, MAI Capital Management's chief equity strategist. Chris, always great to get your thoughts here. We heard the discussion with Libby right now. Let's talk a little bit about what it means and what it means for voters this cycle. It's inflation. Promising to bring it down is President Biden. Consumer prices are a key sector, right? A key part of sectors like food and other staples. Where do you see opportunities with regard to how to play that inflation battle, so to speak, that everybody is trying to fight right now?
Sure, Dom. Well, first of all, Dom, it's always good to be with you again. On inflation, I think the important thing here is it's down, but boy, the president's getting tagged with it, and it's not gone. So especially in the grocery store. So what we're looking for is a company that can sell smaller items. You mind inflation a lot more if you're buying something that costs $100 than if you're buying, say, a candy bar. So we like Hershey's. And Hershey's is suffering right now because cocoa prices are at record highs. And so Hershey's is selling at a record low valuation for Hershey's. So what we think will happen is cocoa prices will moderate eventually, as they always do, and you'll get a double tailwind of the profits increasing because the raw ingredient cost has gone down, but also the valuation will go up and return to its normal level. So we really like Hershey's here as a way to take advantage of the lingering inflation that we still see at the checkout count.
All right, so that's the consumer staple side. Next up, let's turn our attention to another key point. It's big pharma. President Biden is looking to expand Medicare price negotiation for prescription drugs and cap the costs, things like insulin. Bristol-Myers Squibb already negotiating the price of its blood thinner drug, Eliquis. Chris, you like BMY and another name as well.
I do. I like both BMY and I like Pfizer. And Dom, it's like deja vu all over again, to quote Yogi Berra. At every presidential election year, the pharma companies get beat up early in the year. Their price suffers. If you look at a two-year chart of these guys, they're down drastically over the last 2 years. But price controls never get the support they need to get in Congress in order to pass. And so by mid-year, they start to get a bid, and they end up being pretty good stocks by the end of the year. This is a particularly strong year, I think, for this phenomenon, because these stocks have suffered because so much capital has been sucked out to the Mag 7 and have left stocks like Pfizer and Bristol-Myers with single-digit multiples. And Pfizer, for example, near a 6% dividend yield. And these are investment-grade companies. I think this is a real good risk-reward for folks, and I take advantage of it.
All right. And for the last buy here, it's clean energy and electric vehicles. Biden touting investment in battery technology, charging infrastructure. Chris, you like lithium, and specifically Albemarle.
I do, and I don't like it generally. I think it's a real tough way to make money in the mining stocks and in natural resources generally. But every so often, Dom, just like oil 4 years ago in the pandemic, where it went negative for a day? Anyway, lithium prices are down 80%. All of a sudden, the folks that loved EVs 2 years ago now think there is never going to be another EV sold in the United States. So, and obviously, the truth is somewhere in between. We think EVs are eventually the way of the future. They're catching on much quicker, of course, in China and Europe than they are here. But we think it's coming. And we think buying a lithium producer, I like Albemarle, that's down almost 70% from its highs, would be akin to buying energy stocks 4 years ago. And remember, energy ended up being the best performing sector for the next 2 years after that. So that's the kind of opportunity I think we've got here.
All right, Chris, let's talk about the bail. It's home builders for you. Biden pushing for an annual tax credit for mortgages and freeing up more federal financing for builders. But Chris, you're bearish on these builders. Why?
Yeah, now you've got to put it in context, Dom. On this show 2 years ago, I really liked these guys. And it was because interest rates were starting to come up and the stocks had gone down 50, 60, even some of them 70%. And I saw that as a buying opportunity. Well, we purchased them then. We are now getting out of them. The reason is they've gone way up. They've almost tripled in value. If you look at the XHB, for example, it's just terrific over the last 2 years. And I think the president's proposal of a tax credit for new home buyers is looks good on paper, but it's going to be dead on arrival in a Republican Congress. $10,000 isn't that much compared to the average cost of a home. And I think that it's too little, too late. And I take the profits in a group that's just done terrific and flying in the face of higher interest rates. Who'd have thought the home builders would have been a world beater in that kind of environment?
It's been a terror for sure. Chris Crisanti with MAI Capital Management. Thank you very much. We'll see you soon, Chris.
Thanks, Tom. See ya.
All right. Still ahead on the show, shares of Novo Nordisk lower today, but up more than 6% this week after its experimental weight loss pill saw promising early trial results. Its market cap, by the way, now bigger than Tesla's. We'll get a check on the other big movers coming up next. Welcome back to The Exchange. Markets right now still in the red. At the highs of the session, the Dow was up 179 points. At the low, it was down 86. It's currently down about 49, 50 points right now. The S&P, the NASDAQ composite, the real laggard so far today, and the 10-year note yield just about 4.09%. Well, coming up on the show, it's been a year since the collapse of Silicon Valley Bank, and while we may not feel it acutely here on the East Coast, it's a very big deal in the Bay Area and the West Coast. A look at the impact on both Main Street and the tech industry coming up next. Welcome back to The Exchange. It's been a year since the SVB collapse, the biggest bank bust since the financial crisis, and the end of an institution that was integral to Silicon Valley. Deirdre Bosa joins us now for today's Tech Check. And D, startups are still feeling the pinch, the effects of SVB's collapse.
They absolutely are. So after the collapse, you did see this flight to big banks, but that's not an option for many early stage companies, nor small and medium sized businesses. Their profile is considered too risky, or they may need specialized services, a role that only SVB really provided. A year later, that role still has not been filled. I sat down with Parker Conrad, Rippling CEO, yesterday. You might remember his startup was at the center of the storm because they provided payroll for thousands of companies, not just within tech. Here's how he describes SVB's unique value proposition to startups and Main Street small businesses.
I'll tell you the thing that was unique about Silicon Valley Bank for us, that was why we started working with them. When Rippling was just getting started, when it was like literally working out of like my actual basement, you know, we needed to get a set of very specialized banking relationships to do what we wanted to do, to be able to move money on behalf of clients for payroll. And at the time, you know, most banks, you know, would never work with a company like ours.
SVB was essentially a one-stop shop for many startups, small businesses, and even their employees, providing mortgages or personal loans. And SVB even took equity stakes in the companies themselves and partnered with VCs. So the concern that still exists 1 year later is that the next generation of innovation and entrepreneurs, they aren't getting funded in the new landscape. And that will have greater implications down the road for the so-called innovation economy, Dom.
All right. Deirdre Bosa with the latest Tech Check there on SVB. Thank you very much for that. We'll see you later on. And before we go today, we want to check back in on shares of Novo Nordisk. The FDA has approved Wegovy for cardiovascular risk reduction in people with overweight or obesity and established cardiovascular disease. Novo shares right now paring some of the losses. You can still see they're down on the day. Still, though, keep an eye on Novo Nordisk. That does it for The Exchange. Power Lunch picks things up after this quick break. Have a great weekend, everybody. Markets are down. We'll see you on Monday.
You've been listening to The Exchange. Make sure you're subscribed to get each episode every day. Same time, same place.
Did you hear that? That's what an estimated 500 horsepower sounds like.
Give it to you.
How about that? That's a premium Bang & Olufsen sound system with 18 speakers and a Beosonic sound experience. That's our legacy. You ready to be a part of it? Unlock the energy of the all-electric ZDX Type S. Order now at Acura.com.